Good evening, guests, colleagues, and ladies and gentlemen. My name is Greg Chow, and I'm the Secretary of the Polymer Division of the Royal Australian Chemical Institute, the ICI. It gives me the great pleasure to welcome you tonight here for this year's Solomon Lecture, organized jointly by the ICI and the Australian Academy of Technology Science and Engineering. For these who you may not know the Solomon Lecture series, here is a brief background. Professor David Solomon is a prominent polymer scientist in Australia, and he has made a significant contribution to the development of the polymer research. He's well known for his work on banknotes at the CSIRO, where he led a team and developed the world's first plastic banknotes, and this technology is now used by more than 22 countries. His other significant contribution is the invention of the naltrexone-mediated free radical polymerization method. And due to this pioneer work, he and Dr. Ezra Rosado, is also in the audience today, jointly won the Prime Minister's Science Prize last year. The Solomon Lecture Foundation was established in 2000, and the aim of the Solomon Lecture is to facilitate an internationally renowned polymer scientist to come to Australia and present a series of lectures across Australia, highlighting the important aspect of the modern polymer science and engineering. So we are very honored tonight that this year's Solomon Lecture will be presented by Professor Chris Medyashevsky from Carnegie Mellon University. Chris received his PhD in 1976 at the Polish Academy of Science. He then moved to US, and since 1985, he has been at the Carnegie Mellon University. He currently is a J.C. Warner University Professor of Natural Science and the Director of the Center for Macromolecular Engineering. He also has joint appointment at the University of Pittsburgh and the Polish Academy of Science. So Chris is well known for his pioneer work on the invention of atom transfer radical polymerization method in 1995. Many of us use this ATRP technique every day. Due to Chris's invention, we can now easily make new polymeric architectures, which found many applications in catalysis, drug delivery, and advanced materials. Chris has an extraordinary academic record. He has authored 17 books, 80 book chapters, and more than 765 peer-reviewed scientific papers and 42 US patents. His publications have been cited over 52,000 times, and this makes Chris top 25 most cited chemist in the world, according to the ISC's Chemistry World in December 2011. Chris is an elected fellow of US National Academy of Engineering, fellow of ACS, ACS Polymer Division, and ACS Polymer Material Science and Engineering Division. He is also a foreign member of a number of professional bodies in Poland, Russia, and China. Chris has received many awards in his career, and I can only list a few due to the time. In 2011, Chris was awarded a Wolf Prize in Chemistry in Israel, and many, many of these recipients of this prize in the past won Nobel Prize later. Chris won US Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Award in 2011, that's last year, as well as a Presidential Young Investigator Award in 1989, when Chris was very young. Chris also won many other ACS awards, including a Herman Mark Award in 2011, and also received many awards from Polymer Society of France, Japan, Poland, Belgium, Germany, and the UK. So in tonight's Solomon Lecture, Chris will present us a topic on ATRP from mechanism and synthesis to materials and application. Please note, both tonight's lecture and the question time are recorded. It is now my great pleasure to call on Professor Krzysztof Matyszewski to present the 2011 Solomon Lecture.
Good afternoon, Greg. It's really a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for this very kind introduction. But I feel extremely happy and honored and flattered by this special recognition because, in fact, Dave Solomon is my idol, if I would say, or my guru. How you can really carry very fundamental and important research, but also how it can be useful for society in society making money, in printing money, but many, many other things. And I heard today about some special challenges which are facing society here, how one can prevent evaporation of water and really serve society in continuously new ways. But I must say that a couple of years ago, when it was a celebration of Ezio's birthday, I just, in a certain moment, referred to Ezio and Graham and San as three musketeers, as Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. But I must say that Dave, to me, is like Monsieur Captain de Treville, who really taught musketeers how to behave, how to really present this concept of one for all for one, and how to do intrinsic science and do many things which are, in my opinion, amazing, really. And in addition, he also nurtured some D'Artagnan, like Greg, Chao here. And I think there are many new musketeers being coming from Dave's passion, I think love for science and ability to somehow simplify things to a level that it can be commercially important, not only putting them on cover of some papers, but really making real stuff. So I will try to tell you today a little bit how, inspired by what Dave was doing, we try to do something in some sense similar. On one side, trying to understand how chemistry can be used and how one can control this process of tempering, in some sense, radical polymerization, which was first done by Dave, Ezio, Graham, and essentially Australian community, but also how by us understanding this system, we could reduce amount of copper from sometimes thousands of ppm to single digits ppm and sometimes even less, and how one can eventually apply this process to make some materials. And I will give you some examples of a block of polymers, molecular brushes, some functionalite colloids, and also some surfaces. And eventually, if time would permit, I will finish with some applications because we work with several companies, and here is a list of nearly 50 companies. And in fact, I feel very sad that the only continent is Australia, where they are not represented. We have one company at a certain moment from Africa, but maybe in the future from Australia as well. So funding essentially comes predominantly from NSF and some other governmental agencies, but we have also this industrial component, which I think gives a lot of motivation for students and something which you do here in Australia extremely well and extremely successful. So I would like with a slide which really shows how important polymers are. And if you look at the really development of polymers production versus steel, now we are by volume basis really overcoming steel significantly. But I put this 1967 year because I look at certain dates in Dave Solomon career when he was getting at that time a doctorate of science in University of New South Wales. And I think Ezio was graduating with BS at nearly the same year. I was graduating from a high school, so I was a little bit younger, but I think Greg was not yet born probably at that time even. But in fact, I put this 67 because it was a time when it was a really some very interesting movie. Maybe younger generation don't know what is it, but it's a movie, The Graduate, with Dustin Hoffman. And this leg, I think, comes from Annie Bancroft. She was a Mrs. Robinson. If you like Beatles, it was a very nice song of Mrs. Robinson. And the movie was essentially about what to do with a young life. And I was thinking about, like, Dustin Hoffman. I was a graduate at that time from the high school. And he was getting an advice from Mr. Robinson. So,
just one word. Yes, sir. I'm listening. Yes, sir. Plastics. Exactly. How do you move? There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. What do you think about it?
Yes, sir.
I've said that's a deal.
So in fact, you know, I was also thinking about it, and I was inspired by this movie, but also later by work by Dave Solomon, and also by Ezio and Graham. And we started progressively following these steps into radical polymerization. And in 90s, or maybe even late 80s, when many people didn't know about what could be done with controlled radical polymerization or living radical polymerization. This work was going a lot in Australia, but we jumped into this field probably in the mid-90s, starting looking at some nitroxides, some metal-mediated systems, but eventually started doing atom transfer radical polymerization, which for some reasons is probably one of the most often used techniques because it is commercially all ingredients are available. And I think RAFT now being commercially available will probably grow with the same or maybe even larger rate. So right now, if you look at the number of papers on ATRP looking at ISI or Size Funder Scholar, you will see probably around 12,000 papers, which maybe around 1,200 or maybe 1,500 papers per year published. So it is like a 3-4 papers per day, including abstracts in that case, you know, so maybe real papers would be a little bit less. So this is really quite large activity in academia, but also quite large activity in industry if you look at number of patents. And partially, I think, could be explained by some quotation which was made by Bob Madsen from DuPont, who was a long collaborator, I think, of Australian team here, who estimated, or maybe a bit overestimated, the anticipated market being in a range of $20 billion a year. So this value is like 10% of all polymer market, but this is 10% not by volume, but by market share. So no commodities, but at this stage, and probably in the next couple of years, will be high specialties, including coatings, adhesives, surfactants, dispersants, lubricants, some thermoplastic elastomers, sealants, cosmetics, nanocomposites, electronics, biomaterials, some kind of the advanced materials with a value added to it. So how one can make this controlled radical polymerization? And essentially, if one would compare conventional radical process, where by some kind of slow initiation, whether using peroxides or diazo compounds or high energy processes, one can generate radical which would propagate very quickly with a frequency of monomer addition maybe 1 millisecond. But after 1 second time, these chains terminate by combination or by disproportionation. And the life of propagating chain is only 1 second. So 1 second is not time enough to make any kind of a synthetic process. So the challenge for many years was how one can extend this 1 second life of propagating chain to something like an hour or maybe a couple hours or even a day. And the concept which was first introduced by Dave and Ezio and Graham and eventually by us and many others, it relies on the idea that one can provide chance of this radical to propagate maybe once or twice, and then one can send it from the active to a dormant state. And then these dormant species stay sleeping dormant for maybe 10 seconds or maybe a minute. And then this bond homolytically cleaves, regenerates radical, which can propagate once or twice and go back to a dormant state. So there are many possibilities how one can control it. But essentially, the essence is such that one takes this 1 second life of propagating chain in either way, whether it is conventional or controlled, and then chops it on 1,000 pieces, 1 millisecond each, and inserts 1 minute dormant state in between. So this 1 second is still 1,000 milliseconds plus 1,000 minutes. So it's like a day expanding from 1 second time, like accordion, to a day or sometimes even more. or if you wish to compare it to our human life, if we will be perfectly active for one day and sleeping in a dormant state for 1 month, our life will be extended 30 times. So instead of living 70 years, we'll be living 2,000 years. So people from the Jesus Christ time will be still walking here, maybe even attending this lecture. So we need to stay really perfectly dormant. Of course, we cannot do that, but we can do it with radicals. And in that case, we can extend even not 70 times, but sometimes 1,000 times, sometimes even 100,000 times. So one process relies on really spontaneous cleavage of this bond. So it should be a weak bond between carbon and some kind of a counter radical eventually, like nitroxides, like maybe vitamin B12 chemistry, cobalt porphyrin. But in that case, you need really one of these species per every chain. So we are thinking, can we make it a little bit cheaper? Can we take, instead of a nitroxide, can we take a bromine or chlorine? However, if you would like to have a homolytic cleavage for bromine and chlorine, you would need to go for temperatures maybe 300 degrees, maybe 400 degrees, in order to have a sufficient rate of cleavage, which of course will give a lot of side reactions and many complications. So one needs to reduce activation energy barrier by using some kind of a catalytic process. So in that case, we're using here as a catalyst transition metal, which can take this halogen atom and self-oxidize, produce a radical which can propagate a couple times and then be deactivated to a dormant state. And of course, there is another possibility. In that case, it's a degenerate process, and this is the famous example of a raft, but also some other metals, or sometimes even metalloids or atoms such as iodine, and it was precedented by oligometacrylates. These are developments on addition fragmentation polymerization. These are a little bit different because in that case, you have equilibrium constant 1, so whatever is on the left, on the right side of this equation is essentially the same, which means it's a degenerate process because you don't gain anything from this equilibrium 1, but you continuously supply radicals in order to compensate for termination, because radicals would always terminate. In ATRP and nitroxide, in principle, is different because you can internally activate these systems. So this is an example of the exchange reactions in some sense, illustrated by two different complexes and two different catalysts. And they can go from one to the other chain, sometimes providing halogen exchange, something what Devon Shipp was doing in my lab originally, a student from Dave Solomon. But in principle, you have here two chains to catalysts. Very often, you may have 100 chains, one catalyst, or maybe even 1,000 chains, one catalyst. So it will be activating, deactivating many different species continuously, allowing this propagation to occur. So if you look at the first example, which was published in 95, we wanted to make polymerization of styrene under kind of environmentally friendly conditions, no solvent, bulk polymerization of styrene. So we need to go above the vitrification temperature of polystyrene, 110 degrees. And we mimic, in some sense, the dormant species in a propagation by the secondary benzyl bromide, which would be exactly like a model for polystyrene. And we use mimicking systems from the organic chemists, copper complex by 2 bipyridyl units, because it was the best catalyst for atom transfer radical additions. And the reaction occurs in a way that bromine bridges between carbon and copper in a transition state, and then oxidizes this tetrahedral copper 1 to trigonal bipyramidal copper 2 and produces a radical. Radicals, of course, terminate and also propagate. Small radicals terminate extremely fast, maybe rate coefficients 10 to power 9, but because they propagate, they become longer, they also lead to the conversion increase, higher viscosity, which means that this rate coefficient diffusion control drops to 10 to power 8 or sometimes even 7. But also, every act of termination produces this copper 2 species. In fact, it's a counter how many termination steps you have in a system, because every act of termination produces this paramagnetic species. You can use EPR, you can use sometimes UV or some other technique to measure how many chains are dead. And in this particular case, would be around maybe 5% of chains. We can go to as low as 1%, sometimes maybe 0.1% under some conditions, but always there would be some termination. And you can measure essentially how much. So if you have a concentration of a species sufficiently large, this radical takes halogen atom and converts back to a dormant state. And then after some time, you have predominantly activation, propagation, deactivation, activation, propagation, deactivation. Now I put here these two in boxes, kinetic laws. So one tells you that rate of polymerization depends on activity of a catalytic system, monomers ratio of these rate coefficients, but also on a ratio of concentration of copper 1 to copper 2. Not on the total amount of copper, but only on a ratio, which means if I can keep ratio the same, I can, in principle, reduce amount of copper 10 times, 1,000 times, million times, I can have the same rate of polymerization. So you could ask me, why do I need copper if I can reduce it 1,000 or million times? I need copper concentration enough because I need to send this propagating radical to a dormant state quickly enough. Otherwise, it would propagate like in a conventional redox-initiated system once forever until it would terminate. I need to prevent this propagation and allow maybe 1, 2, 5, or 10 additions. And how many additions, it depends on concentration of copper 2, which would define polydispersity in this system. Maybe as IUPAC commission says, dispersity, right? So dispersity can be predicted if you know these rate coefficients, conversion, and concentration of copper 2. So for example, if I want to make a polystyrene 10,000 molar mass at 90% conversion with dispersity 1.2, I can tell you that 5 ppm of copper is enough for control. If you would go to 100,000, it would be half a ppm. So can I run the reaction with 5 ppm of copper? We tried, and we miserably failed. Why? Because if I have only 5 ppm of copper 1, at maybe 1% monomer conversion, I already terminated more chains than I put copper in. So it means that reaction would stop at 1-2% monomer conversion. So in principle, it's a paradox, because I have a 5 ppm of copper enough for control, but I need maybe 1,000 ppm of copper in order to run the reaction to completion. So how it can be solved? So what we proposed a couple years ago is a process based on the continuous regeneration of the activator. So we call it ARGET as activators regenerated by electron transfer and another process like ICOR. So if I know that 5 ppm of copper is enough for control, but because of the irreversible termination, I would convert all copper 1 to copper 2, can I regenerate these species by using some mild reducing agents? For example, something as simple as phenols, sugars, amines, sometimes you can have even monomer itself as a reducing agent, like dimethyl aminoethyl methacrylate, or even ligands. You can use hydrazine, ascorbic acid, you can put some metals like iron, magnesium, zinc, or copper zero. You can also use AIBN, like you do in RAFT reagents, to compensate for termination. AIBN would be reacting with copper 2, reducing to copper 1, and producing also some new alkyl halide, which can initiate new chains. So in principle, it's not only that I can regenerate this copper 1 this way, but also I produce some oxidized species. If I start with a T2 octoate, which is FDA approved even as a food additive, after this reduction process, I produce T4, which is really much more strong Lewis acid, is a little bit toxic. If I look at copper zero, I would put more copper to a system. AIBN would produce new chains. So in principle, it works beautifully, but I have some side products, and these side products are not very desirable. So can I avoid these side products? How can I avoid formation of this oxidized agent? And this is a challenge. So we are thinking, can we put something as simple, because it's a redox process, as electrons or electrical current? Can I plug in a battery to my reaction system? And can I reduce copper 2 to copper 1 using cathodic current? But also, can I apply anodic current and oxidize copper 1 to copper 2 and stop the reaction? So by changing electrochemical potential, I can change the ratio of these two species. But in fact, I don't supply any chemical reagent. It's only electrical current, which would play a role to the reducing agent. So this really works very nicely. So this is the scheme shown here. But if you look at the cyclic voltammogram, if I start with a sufficiently positive potential, there is only copper 2 species stable, no polymerization because I need copper 1 to start the reaction. But if I progressively make a potential more and more negative, the amount of copper 1 increases, and then I will have a reaction faster and faster and faster, and eventually there would be some kind of a transport limit, and in that case I can return the current and this is a classical duck shape of this cyclic voltammogram. So for example, if I apply this current here, negative 400 millivolts, what you see here, there is no polymerization. But then I switch it to 700, there is a reaction. And then I stop it and I restart it. Stop and restart. Stop, go, stop, go. I can repeat it many times, but you could see that molecular weight distribution is very narrow and everything shifts towards higher molecular weight. Molar mass nicely increases with conversion, and here we have these couple points during the off period. And dispersity decreases to something like 1.05. So this is, in fact, quite nice, but it's probably a kind of a half of a story because I only change potential in a relatively narrow range. What will happen if I would go to more and more negative potential? In principle, reaction go faster, but also what can happen is that you start reducing kappa 1 and form kappa 0. So at this potential here, nice kinetics, molar mass grow, polydispersity, and current profile. What happens if I go to this value? In fact, reaction slows down dramatically. You could see that here, 1.5 hour, 80% conversion. Then at this much more negative potential, 8 hours, 94% conversion. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work, but at the same time, what you see, color of this reaction mixture changes quite strongly. So copper 2 gets out, and you see copper 0 deposited on this platinum electrode. So this is, in fact, a very simple way to remove copper from the system, because this copper gets reduced to copper 0, which goes on the electrode. Now, what happens if I would go to much more positive potential? I can strip practically all of the copper back to solution, and reaction could be potentially restarted. So this original concentration of copper 2 dropping and then increasing. So 90% of copper can be stripped back from the electrode, or sometimes even larger amount, depends on the time also. So now if I go to this original potential, you start seeing something very interesting, because kinetics is the same, molar mass the same, polydispersity the same, current the same. So I can remove a copper and put it back to solution reversibly several times. So sometimes people really complain what to do with this copper. You can put the electrode, deposit, and then strip it back and restart the reaction again. Now, this still requires a kind of a potential stat, and not everybody does this electrochemistry very easily. We're thinking, can we simplify that? Can we really use a 1.5-volt battery, this energizer, which in fact is not 1.5, it's 1.61 if you measure it. And then you have to select right conditions and simply connect this battery to the working and counter electrode without reference electrode, and you could see quite decent control of molar mass and low polydispersity. So this works quite nicely, but there are many other possibilities. One is, can we go to the water as a solvent, especially for some bio-related systems, maybe some water-soluble system. Maybe we can walk on water in the future, as Dave proposes. But water gives really, in fact, quite strong effect on ATRP for reasons that this copper 2 species is much more ionic than copper 1. You could see that equilibrium constant in ATRP in water is 10,000 times larger than in acetonitrile, which gives dramatic challenge because you will be flooded with radicals if you would do conditions like in acetonitrile. So if you apply too high potential, in that case here, you could see a reaction goes but then stops and there is no control, 1.5 big tailing and so on. If you go to this potential, much less negative, reaction goes to 99% conversion, good control of molar mass, low dispersity, narrow shift of entire molecular weight distribution. So this is something which really can be used in an advanced system. But I wanted to show you something from another postdoctoral fellow who is Australian, but also, in addition, he's Polish. So his name is Dominik Konkolewicz. He was working with Sebastian Perrier. And he was thinking, can we do something even simpler? Can we use light as a reducing agent? So in order to do that, you need to work sometimes with a precisely controlled light. I will talk about it maybe in more details tomorrow. But Dominik is a very practical man, so he took this drum, which is really coming from shipping chemicals, and then he bought 2 meters of LEDs which were violet, blue, and red, and glued them to the surface, put reaction mixture inside. He checked really that this is really quite monochromatic value, and it works really, really nicely. So here's an example of polymerization of two different monomers. We use copper-2 at the beginning, so oxidatively stable, no problem. And then we use 100 ppm of this copper and irradiate that with a violet, with blue, and red. You could see red does not work at all. The violet is better than blue, but this is methyl methacrylate, nice increase of molar masses, dispersity is 1.1 at the end. Methyl acrylate, similar control. Red, not thin, blue, and violet. And dispersity here below 1.05. So it really works very nicely. And unfortunately, sun is not as often in Pittsburgh as it is in Australia, but Dominic went on a roof of his Mellon Institute with Graham and some others visited. And this was quite sunny day, so maybe this was not a picture which he took, it's from the web, I guess, but this is Cathedral of Learning next to the Mellon Institute. And you could see that putting just reaction directly on the sun without any additional irradiation, the solar irradiation gives you even faster reaction, but control is preserved, good control of molar mass and distributions 1.1 or so. One can do it even like previously, this on-off switch, because you could see here by having exposure to light, reaction goes, and then in a dark, stops, and so on. Molar mass increases. This is methyl acrylate, methyl methacrylate, both of them in a similar way. Acrylates generally are easier to control than methacrylate, so a little bit lower dispersity. This can be extended also to make block copolymers. So this is done with methyl methacrylate and then extended with ethyl acrylate, and you could see quite nice shift of molar mass distribution. And one can work also in water. So you have water as a solvent, sun. In Australia, would be much easier because you can do it reproducibly every day, I guess. But in Pittsburgh, you have to wait maybe for good sunny weather. And this is really shift of this peak quite nice and dispersity are quite decent still in water. So how this system really works? We are thinking that there are really two possible processes. One is that light may activate copper-1, and also that light may reduce copper-2, so it would be photoreduction process. So we did some model reactions in the presence of TEMPO as a trapping reagent. This was really like origin of the nitroxide-mediated polymerization, Graham and Ezio and Dave, same rate of the reaction, with light, without light. So copper-1 is not activated, photoactivated. It may be different from iridium and some other complexes. So what happens really, you reduce copper-2 species, you produce copper-1, which is needed for activation, and also you produce some bromine radicals, which do something. They initiate polymerization. If you have no alkyl halide in a system, you produce high molecular weight material because some chains would need to be activated. But if you have a copper-1 and alkyl halide in a sufficient concentration, this alkyl halide dominates, like in a raft process, that small amount of chains initiated by ABN do not matter. So it is 1-2% of newly generated chains. So it's a really like a combination of the ARGAT process, because ARGAT is this reduction, but also this halogen in some sense produces new chains, so it's a little bit like an ICAR. So maybe ICAR, ARGAT, so maybe just we can call it photo-ATRP. So let me summarize these reduction processes in few words, that we can use really mild reducing agents, because if they would be too rash, too hard, in that case, this reduction process would be too quick, and you would have too many radicals, too much termination. So if you are very active, you can dose them by a syringe, essentially. But everything depends on the strength of reducing agent, but also on the KATRP. In principle, if you want to work with a ppm of copper, you need to have a predominantly copper-2, not copper-1 species. So you need species with a very high activity, like TPMA, hexamethylated trend, PMDTA, and some others. But concerning reducing agent, you can have really organic species, even monomers or ligands. You can have inorganic species, even something as sulfides. So in fact, I brought this demonstration here. This is, I believe, Shiraz. Shiraz contains approximately 100 ppm of sulfides. If you go to white wine, it's 200 ppm, and dessert wine is 400 ppm. And you can run this reaction essentially better in a dessert wine than in a red wine, but Shiraz works also. And you could see here methyl acrylate polymerization, initiated by classical bromoisobutyrate and a little bit of a sulfites, and you could see that molar mass very nicely increased with conversion. Everything works like a charm. So you can go from easily thousands to hundreds, sometimes 10, sometimes even 1 ppm. It depends on molar mass, depends on the degree of control. In fact, by amount of copper, you can also control polydispersity of molecular weights. And this gives additional possibility of controlling polymer morphologies and some others. So in principle, it's a question how these ATRP things develop. We started in 95 from normal ATRP, then went to this agate, still high concentration copper two, but quite robust system because it was error stable, and then going to these parts per million and this, and last year we started using eATRP, going to water as a medium, and using photopolymerization, using sometimes even other transition metals, and some ligands, which I will discuss tomorrow, which have activities even 100 times larger than those which are now available. So the question would be, what will be next? And of course, next, we don't know what will be, but there would be some possibilities developing new systems, maybe which will have a better activity, lower toxicity, more robust, and others. But I think that probably one challenge which we had in all radical processes is oxygen. Oxygen is a very, very important inhibitor. And normally, we all what we do, we bubble nitrogen through, we degas, we go to dry box, we go to Schlenkline, complicated system. So can we run the reactions sometimes like, you know, here in a glass of wine and start the reaction? In principle, you can do that because you know that 5 ppm of copper is good to control this reaction. But also, if you use very active, very strongly reducing catalyst, they are oxygen sensitive and they get oxidized very easily to copper two, which is a bad thing, sometimes dangerous. But if I have enough reducing agent, I can reduce it back to copper one and then oxidize, and maybe after 10 or 100 cycles, I remove all oxygen and polymerization starts. How good control one can get from these polymerizations? So this is really example of growing from a flat silicon wafer, something which is called now as a cap, as a new possibility. And these are really quite simple reactions because you can put this wafer with an initiator, monomer, copper two, ligand, solvent, some extra initiator. And of course, there is no reaction because you're on this side of equilibrium, only with copper two. But if you put a cap on this and you inject a reducing agent, it reduces copper two to copper one, gets oxidized after 100 cycles, oxygen is gone, polymerization starts. So we did these reactions a couple of years ago. And in fact, it is not very easy to measure how much polymer you form from a flat surface because it's essentially micrograms or even less. And you may use some very fancy MALDI maybe to find out what is it. But we are using here ellipsometry. And you could see how polymer thickness evolves with molecular weight. And when people did first these experiments, they could have a hard time to believe that graphene density, which is a slope of this line, is approaching something like a half a chain per square nanometer. So normally, if you graft onto, in that case, polymer of 100,000 molar mass would probably cover 10 by 10 square nanometers, so grafting density would be nearly 100 times less. Because polymers want to be random coil. They hate to be stretched like that. So this is something which really, you pay tremendous entropic penalty to get these things stretched so much. So how does it work? Some people call it it's a new state of matter, Takeshi Fukuda, Takahara, and the others. In principle, if you know how to do it, you can work nearly like a chemical vapor deposition, that you will have a first layer of monomer, second, third, fourth, and if you have a dimers or trimers, they can be stretched because they are oligomers. They don't care. They don't know what this entropic penalty will be later. But eventually, they continue to grow, and they have nothing else to do but continue to grow. Of course, some would terminate and so on. But so it is really like growing grass on a Wimbledon. And if you have a conventional radical process, in that case, it would be like a jungle. Some chains would be very long, some very short. They would never see light. They would never have a chance to be exposed to monomer catalysts and so on. So they behave in a very special way because they are very, very dense. Grafting density is so high that they cannot entangle. They would slide one on top of the other one. I mentioned to Greg today that there was a probably a year and a half ago, very nice paper by Jacob Klein and Stephen Arms using phosphorylcholine, which is a sphetero-ionic polymer. And Jacob says that with a force of 1 gram, he can push 1,000 kilograms, so 1 ton of a material. So friction coefficient is like 0.01, much less than in a knee cartridge. So there are some possibilities of maybe expanding this cap system also in a way, because they would be more robust surfaces. Toyota wants to use them in some engine compartments to reduce friction. So I think it's a really new possibility making these hybrid materials. And it's very simple, because like in a cap system, you can take wafer from one flask and put it to another, and you have a block of polymer, and then you can return it to make a tri-block or sometimes ABC block and some others. So I think this lubrication is one story, but also it's very easy to make a biocompatible surfaces, because even if a polymer matrix is not very biocompatible, if it is grafted with a very dense layer of something which is bioinert, it acts like a stealth surface, and any sensing molecule cannot penetrate it and can find out what is beneath that. People are talking about many other possibilities using antimicrobial, non-corrosive materials, and some others. But I think that probably one of the major interests in some sense and opportunities is to design molecules. So it is really like a process of macromolecular engineering that you start from the thinking what you can do, you design materials like engineers do, then you make it preparatively, then you characterize it, what kind of properties they have, and you see whether they match your expected target material properties. And sometimes you can have a second cycle. So if you look at these parameters, which we typically do, we have this control of composition going from statistical to blocky periodic gradient structures, controlling topology from linear to stars, which is a star master here, Greg Chow, and graft copolymers, networks, some branch polymers, and putting many functionalities, which essentially are very important, especially for the low molar mass materials. But I think it's also interesting to combine these concepts together. So we can have not only just simple star-like structure, but star with a micto arms, and maybe with two different functionalities for two different cross-linking processes, or making this pom-pom-like structure, or making this block cyclic gradient structure, or making some special gradient and side chain gradient materials and so on. And I think if you know how to use ChemDraw or Adobe Illustrator, you can draw all of these structures very easily. But it's a question, can you make them, and how you can check how precisely you make them? So I will show you some examples, and this example of a molecular brush, which is a project in collaboration with Sergei Sheko at UNC, which is made in a very, in some sense, simple way. We start with a polyhydroxyethyl metacrylate, so it's the same polyhema which is used in contact lenses. We convert this polymer of DP400 to bromo esters, and then we grow side chains, polybutylacrylate. So this polybutylacrylate is essentially a very soft material, and you can count how many chains you have if you are lucky with your collaborator and he's lucky with his probe and his student, so it doesn't work every day. But polybutylacrylate works on mica because it's very soft, but also it has a quite strong adhesion to the monolayer of water on mica surface. Tg is minus 50, so if you put a drop, it's a liquid material, if you put a drop of that, you could see something unusual. That this is really monolayer, something which may be interesting for controlling what happens on the water surface. It's a monolayer of these brushes, which really spread by mostly gravity and some other forces. And you have a plug-like diffusion, and then diffusion of individual chains. You could see both of them, and then rotation interaction between them. They occur with three different traits. So this is really like an experiment which Franklin did some time ago, putting a drop of oil on water, measuring Avogadro number, and what you do now, reducing by this self-assembly monolayer tension and evaporation. It's something similar, but on a molecular level, that you can observe these species. So you can really see individual molecules in such a way. And they can be done in various ways. So we can make them sometimes star-like, so starting from tetrafunctional initiator and making four arms, and then exchanging them on bromines and grafting these side chains. So you could see it's a statistical process, so they are not perfectly the same. Some of them would be a bit longer, some shorter, but they are stretched. If you want to see curvature, You need to, typical for meandering of polymer chains, which are described usually as cooked spaghetti, we need to have a long enough spaghetti. So this is something which degree of polymerization 4,000, so half a million more or less backbone. And then we graft these side chains, and grafting density is so high because every second carbon atom here, every quarter nanometer, we have a side chain of a 1 nanometer diameter. So on a flat surface, if I put half of them left and right, half of them are still sitting on a backbone in a desorbed state. They would love to go to surface, but there is no space. If you make them longer and longer and longer, they become, in fact, more and more stretched because they have a high affinity towards surface. So here's an example of a brush, which you could see here. It's a 5 micron size. So these are 1 micron fully stretched polymeric molecules. So I had this collaboration with Sergei a couple years ago about this project, and I sent him these samples. He said, magnificent. I have never seen anything like that. But next day he called me, you gave me garbage. And he showed me that. And next day he said, I'm sorry, it's perfect. And made something like that. Next day he said, no, it didn't work. Send me something better. So we were very confused. But the reality is that it was a surface for analysis a little bit different. If you go to the high surface energy like water, surface tension becomes so large. The side chains would like to land on a surface so much that they stretch the backbone to a level that you break carbon-carbon bond. Very, very strong bond, but surface tension is so large. If you have a lower surface energy, this is aqueous methanol, they are stable nearly forever. So in fact, there are a couple parameters which affect this process. So of course, surface energy is one. Of course, time is the other one, but also structural parameter. If I go above certain threshold of these side chains, they have an attraction to a surface so much that they create tension comparable with a carbon-carbon bond, which is 140 kT more or less. So you need to go above this value. But you can see really what happens in, it's like a chemical reaction watching with real time. You could see 5 minutes, 2 hours. There is a cleavage of a carbon-carbon bond progressively occurring until you form species which are more or less like stars. There is no more space for them, and they are happy, and you cannot go below this land more or less 100 nanometers. So this is really a kind of a warning that if you make a very complex structures, what is in solution and what is on a surface is different. You have a fatal attraction to a surface, which sometimes can cleave dendrimers, macromolecular brushes, which are sometimes thermodynamically unstable because they were made in a different way. So this is really cleavage of thousands of these bonds. And I can ask a question, can I cleave only one bond selectively in a complicated structure like that? So the simple solution is you need to make a one bond weaker, right? So if I start from the initiator, which is disulfide containing, which is a bond much, much weaker, then I grow 2 chains, and then I decorate them with side chains, and when I land them on a surface, you could see very quickly these bond cleaves, and then much slower carbon-carbon bond cleaves. So this is sulfur-sulfur, this is carbon-carbon. It's a dramatic change in the kinetics of the process. So how can I control the rate of this reaction? Surface tension, length of a chain, and sometimes even surface energy. Can I do something else? So if you look at the disulfide bond, I can still use something like a reducing agent, like dithiotritol, and then this dithiotritol can accelerate the reaction. It was not obvious. If this dithiotritol can find this one single sulfur-sulfur bond in a brush, which would be accessible to do that. But this works really like a charm. You could see that here having 20 micromolar concentration goes dramatically faster already. If I go 10 times higher concentration, it's nearly instantaneous cleavage. So you could follow how this rate is affected by concentration of DTT. And this gives, in fact, very interesting information, what happens on the surface of water. And Dave and Greg probably know very well that there are really 2 groups of people. Some say water surface is acidic. The other one says water surface is basic. And they are split more or less 50-50. So here, you could really say, what happens if you have a polybutyl acrylate brush on the surface? Because you can follow, according to this equation, how this rate is affected by pH. So you could say, what is a pH on water surface? And apparently, it's quite acidic, 3.7. So it's still possible that what you have on the surface, you may have this first layer of water can be rearranged maybe through hydrogen bonding to polybutyl acrylate and having some, you know, more acidic OH structures. But if you have a polybutyl acrylate, I can tell you that the surface pH is around 3.7, so it's pretty acidic. So let me go now to two topics. One is related to the biostructures, and we try to make protein polymer hybrids for a couple of reasons, because they have a higher stability, improved therapeutic activity for enzymes would be also important for stability and longer circulation times, reduced dosage, toxic effects. You can make them in two different ways. One way is to graft polymer onto protein, and the other one, graft monomer and eventually polymer from protein. This one, I think it's a good one, but also it's difficult to separate because very often molar mass of both species is similar. You need to use large excess of polymer. It's not easy to separate. This one is much easier for separation because one uses really one monomer, so you could have a dialysis to remove a polymer, monomer and catalyst and so on, and potential would be much easier using various polymer which can be applied for this process. It's not a new idea. In fact, we did some time ago, but without really very good control. And these are some examples from literature from Heather Maynard. She was using protein with NIPAM polymerization. You see the macroinitiator still left at the end of the reaction, long tailing, so somehow it doesn't work in the right way. This is a myoglobin reaction with under ATRP conditions. Again, unreacted macroinitiator, long tailing, didn't work. We thought that maybe it's a really question of the initiator, so we had a collaboration with Ryan Mell, who put at this green fluorescent protein at a position precisely at the bottom of a barrel, 134, ATRP initiator, and activity of a hybrid is okay, but you could see still unreacted macroinitiator and tailing. So what can we do about it? In fact, there are many challenges if you do in water. If you want to do it under biorelevant conditions, which we define it as a water or sometimes even buffer, amount of a monomer, organic phase, should not be more than 20%, typically 10-20%, so high dilution. Dilute protein solution to prevent aggregation, and also low temperature to prevent protein denaturation. So why water is a challenge? I told you, huge equilibrium constant, 100 or 10,000 times larger than acetonitrile. So I need to adjust conditions. Sometimes you can also cleave this bond. You can also hydrolyze alkyl halide. You can have also disproportionation, so many things. So how you can optimize these conditions? So first we look at a model compound. So this is water-soluble polyethylene oxide bromoterminated. And then we took also protein. This was a cheap BSA, which was functionalized on average with 30 ATRP units. You can see that by mass spectroscopy because it's cheap, which has destroyed using potassium hydroxide and isolate polymers, and look how good they are. So we used two different initiating catalytic systems. One, which was very active, so this is trispyridylmethylamine, which is 3,000 times more active than BP. And also we play with a bromine chlorine, this is maybe 10 times or 15 times more active. It's water, so typically in organic solvent, we'll use maybe 90% copper 1, 10% copper 2. Here in water, we reverse. We use 10% copper 1, 90% copper 2. Another approach is that we start only with copper 2, and we use this ascorbic acid as a reducing agent in the amount needed to reduce it to the copper 1 state and start the reaction. So first results were, in fact, quite surprising. We are using only 10% of copper 1, but you could see that TPMA does not work at all. But BP works quite nicely. So BP gives you dispersity maybe 1.1 under some conditions, but TPMA at the beginning gives you some polymer, but probably it's too many radicals, you terminate too much, although you have only 10% of copper 1. So one solution is less copper 1. So we start with only copper 2 and add 0.3% ascorbic acid. So reaction goes and stops. Then we add another 0.3%, another 0.3%. It continues to polymerize and quite good control of the reaction. Low dispersity, good increase of molar mass. So why not to use a continuous process using just a syringe with a rate of addition of ascorbic acid 8 nanomole per minute And you could see that conversion nicely increase, dispersity stay low, molar mass increase nicely with conversion. So this system really works and can be also extended to PBS buffer. PBS buffer is a challenge because copper phosphate is very poorly soluble. If you add copper to PBS buffer, it precipitates immediately. But if you add copper TPMA complex, it's strongly enough complexin, it doesn't precipitate. So you could see here with PBS buffer, and this is with BSA initiator, high conversion, good control of molar mass and dispersities. You can work also at low concentration of copper. So here is a ICAR process with a little bit of diazo initiator. And if you reduce copper 150, 25 ppm, you could see that this system really works, especially here on molar mass dispersities. Below 20 ppm, it doesn't work. You have a too high molar mass, too high dispersities, but around 20 ppm is probably a limit which one can use. So to conclude this part, we really, if you want to use BP, 90% copper to 10% copper one should work. If you want to go to this more challenging system with a lower copper concentration, it's better to use TPMA and feeding of ascorbic acid with a very slow rate to prevent too much extensive termination. So I would like to show you two more things. One is really based on block copolymers. And this is a block copolymer which we want to use for some electronic-like materials. It is known that polyacrylonitrile is used commercially for carbon fibers of the size of microns or sometimes even tens of microns. But we would like to go to nano dimensions using microphase separation block copolymers. So we make polyacrylonitrile block with polybutyl acrylate, which is incompatible, so they would phase separate. And depending on the ratio of these two blocks and also dispersity, some other parameters, they could go from spheres, cylinders, bicontinuous, lamellae, and vice versa, and so on. So really, what happens in this case? We had, for example, this lamellae-like structure, and then we separate them or cast a film, and this was done by zone casting, so it is zone refining process when you progressively move a zone here. They are very nicely ordered of a size of approximately 30 nanometers. And then we heat them in the presence of oxygen or air, 250 degrees. Polyacrylonitrile gets crosslinked, so it doesn't go through order-disorder transition temperature. And then you heat it in the nitrogen, 450 degrees, polybutyl acrylate disappears, and you are left with carbon. But this carbon, in fact, is quite special. First, you can control size of these domains, 10, 20 nanometers easily, but also edges. On the edges, you have these pyridinic nitrogens, and they have a special function. They capture very well CO2. They act for as oxygen reduction catalyst. Also, they have a high pseudocapacitance, so it is good for the supercapacitors and some other applications. So this is an example of the different morphology. This is really filaments of carbons. We could make spheres and some others as well. And sometimes to show you how different these structures are from the classical carbon fibers, I use an example of taking, let's say, carbon fiber, which would be 50 micron, relatively thick, so it would be like human hair diameter. So 50 micron diameter, if you take a 1 cubic centimeter, 1 gram of the precursor, do you know how long this single fiber will be? It's approximately 500 meters. And now if you go to this 50 nanometers fiber, in that case, it would be, roughly speaking, 2,000 by 2,000 times longer. So it becomes 1.5 million kilometers. And the thinnest we ever made were 3 nanometers, of course, never continuous, but this would correspond 1 cubic centimeter volume to 150 million kilometers. So they are quite dramatic values. And I think that really what matters is the volume to surface ratio. So we are very good for nanocomposites, but potentially as electronic materials, because you could have a confined space materials as quantum dots or maybe quantum wires or even quantum sheets. So I will finish with the last example of the block copolymer, which is now from renewable resources. So if you look at methyl methacrylate and this material or monomer, which is called tulipalin A, this is exactly the same structure, but you join these two carbon atoms together. So reactivity-wise, should be very similar, But because you have a cyclic structure in a polymer chain, glass transition is dramatically larger, nearly 100 degrees more. So they have a very interesting properties. Price-wise, they smell like tulips, and they cost like tulips. So there is one company in Korea, in fact, trying to make it in a biotechnological way, because they have a very, probably one of the highest TGs of the vinyl polymers and very good optical properties, some interesting biofringence and so on. But reactivity-wise, like PMMA. So one can make block of polymers with acrylates and two tulipalin 8 monomers, and this acts like a thermoplastic elastomers from essentially minus 50 to 250 or 300 degrees. This is PMMA, this is tulipalin 8 for comparison. So I would like to finish with some applications, but in fact, it's a book from 5 years ago now, which shows how macromolecular engineering can be useful. In some sense, we have various synthetic techniques, not only ATRP or controlled radical polymerization like Raft on hydroxide, but ring opening polymerization, which Greg is doing now, metathesis, anionic, cationic, even sometimes condensation can be used in the same way. Second volume really relates to the molecular architecture, then eventually properties and some applications, with really very nice 18 chapters on the bio applications, some electronic applications, advanced materials, and some others. And in fact, what is important to recognize that we as organic chemists generally think about only atomic composition or atomic connectivity. As polymer chemists, we start thinking about topology, microstructure, composition, molar mass distribution, and so on. But if you talk to engineers, they would think that everything depends on processing conditions, on thermal history, mechanical stresses, solvent removal. And I think everybody's a little bit right. But I think what I've seen today in your department, that you have a very good synergistic interactions between chemists and chemical engineers, because it's not only important if you make a semi-crystalline polymer, how it would form what molar mass is, but how it would form these chain-folded crystals or spherulites or sometimes even grains. For block copolymers, not only ratio would matter, but also what solvent you would use for development. So you may have sometimes even lamellae with a 90-10 ratio, not only 50-50. So I think this processing is equally important component. And in this macromolecular engineering which we do, we really rely on one side on maybe intuition. If you want to have a target material properties, we need to design something. We need to design molecules or macromolecules with functionality, composition, topology, and eventually precisely make them, process them, check what properties they have, and maybe we are lucky that we got it. If not, we go another cycle, maybe through some modeling as well. But eventually, if you can be successful or not, is a cost versus performance. So do we need to be perfect? Do we need to make stars with only 6 arms? Maybe 5 is okay, maybe 4 is okay, maybe 3 is okay. So I think one needs to really sometimes incorporate defects and see whether these defects would not give even beneficial factor. Sometimes broader dispersity may be better than very narrow molecular weight distribution or design molecular weight distribution. So I would like to show you some real applications. This is from Kaneka, which was the first one which commercialized ATRP process. They have a plant in Kashima, which is maybe 100 kilometers south from Fukushima. So they were a bit flooded during tsunami, but fortunately not too much. And they are making polymers, mostly polybutyl acrylate, with molar mass in a range of maybe from 5,000 to 50,000. This is an example of the increase of molar mass with conversion. Scale is not very large. It's batch scale or semi-batch, which is approximately 1 ton, and they can do it maybe twice or sometimes 3 times a day if needed. Low dispersity, very good control of functionality. So they do that mostly for sealants. So sealants are with alkoxysilyl group terminated. So therefore, they can be moisture cured, sometimes maybe UV cured as well. And this is comparison of a silicon sealant, classical, after 1 month exposure on artificial marble. And this is ATRP sealant after 4 years. I've seen it after 10 years, looks exactly the same. So they are better because they are much more polar, so they adhere to the surface of minerals better, which are also polar. We have a very good control of dispersity, so there is uniform structure. There is no degradation. Sometimes siloxane can go via ring opening polymerization essentially to cycles, and control of functionality is very good. They do it for various different sealants, but this is one application quite interesting. If you go for the self-cleaning glass, so it's a glass with a very thin layer of titanium dioxide, which acts as a photocatalyst for the extraction of organic impurities, but it cannot destroy inorganic impurities. So in that case, you could see if you use PDMS sealant, it's an inorganic one, so this is worse than a normal window. And if you use a sealant, which they have a consortium together with Saint-Gobain in France and Pinkerton in England, this is window after a couple of years. It's really does not require any kind of a cleaning. This is a sealant also for a gasket, which is for automotive purpose. So this is in Honda, I think, already shown for 4 or 5 years. If you use a classical silicone sealant, in that case, gasoline can vapor can penetrate very easily. In the case of this acrylate sealant, vapor penetration is reduced 10 times. So it's good for environment and also good for the engine performance. This is the last thing, which is in fact quite interesting because it resembles, in some sense, molecular brushes. You have a structure like a brush with these side chains, and they do it in a very simple way. It's a copolymerization of dimethacrylate, dimacromonomer with monomacromonomer. It's a low, really, cross-linking, and a lot of these side chains which act as a diluent, but you don't need a solvent to swell. So they have a very soft, sometimes even 1 kilopascal modulus. So they are super soft. And sometimes they can act also as very nice shock absorbers. So it's an example of the test with an egg. It's a Japanese egg, so you could see that it really absorbs quite nicely energy. It's a soft or maybe even raw egg. And you can go even to a bigger challenge. And I think the main challenge is how you can find, you know, the path on which you can center your egg. And it's a little bit sticky. Because it's only polybutyl acrylate. You add a little bit of a fluoroacrylate, then surface tension changes and you can remove it much easier. So I think with that, I need to also tell you that Graham and Ezio and probably some other people in the audience here, San, they were contributing to this something which I was not sure if maybe I wasted my time half a year of reading all of these chapters and sending some comments. But in fact, half a year ago, nearly, was published this Polymer Science, a Comprehensive Reference, which is like a second edition of the Comprehensive Polymer Science with 7,500 pages and a really dream team of editors and contributors, which I really want to thank again, Graham, for writing even two chapters for that. So I would strongly recommend to look at it because it's also a web edition or e-version. This is not my car. I got it, in fact, I got it from my colleague in Canada, in Ontario. So in Ontario, they have 133 ATRP cars at least. But my wife can really tell that we have a regular plate, you know, without any fancy letters or anything else. So I need to thank really people who did this work. Work on the photo and also electro and some other work was really done by Dominik Konkolewicz, very smart and very nice fellow, the only from Australia, but second after Devon Shipp, who is now professor at Clarkson University. The brushes were made by Asia Brudyńska, this bio staff by Sadia Averick, and also by Tonya Simakova, and a little bit by Kasia Wegner, and electrochemistry by Sangu Park. So these were main people who did this work, but probably some others who are not on this picture as well. And I would like to thank you for your attention and thank again for this tremendous recognition from me. Thank you very much, Dave.
Chris, thank you very much for a very stimulating lecture. You clearly showed us from the basic concept of ATRP to today evolve as a very robust technique in terms of argon ATRP, eATRP, now photo ATRP. And also he showed a number of beautiful examples in terms of where this morphology can be used from ATRP synthesis to a practical application. So I have to look at the underwriter from now on, who has the ATRP? Because in Australia, we just now start from A, I think, in Victoria, the plates number, and just restarting the system again. Now, before I invite the audience for questions, and I would like to call on Professor David Solomon to come forward to present to Chris the Solomon Lecture Memento Cristo.
Firstly, Greg, thank you very much for the invitation. It's very special for me. Chris and I have been friends, obviously, for a long time. He says nice things about me. I'll have to say some about you, but it's very easy to do that, of course. And we share, among other things, a common interest in living controlled radical polymerization. Chris's first paper on ATRP was a seminal paper in polymer synthesis, and you've seen the various applications that they've been able to make with using ATRP. They're very impressive. But what I find even more impressive with Chris's work is that his understanding of the system and the way he integrates and puts together the different forms of ATRP. At Ezio's seminar, we discussed this, and it was very interesting, the magnificent way in which you did that. You even had other living radical systems incorporated in your grand scheme, which I thought was pretty good. But I noticed you've come a long way since then. You've looked at different solvents, different wines. That must be a great paper. When's that going to be published, Chris?
It's expensive, isn't it?
And I guess the justification for that is the pH of water is 3.7, so we better not use that for a solvent. My duty is to make a presentation to you on behalf of the Polymer Division of the RACI and the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering. And I have an object to give you. I called it an object because I wasn't sure what to call it. But when in doubt, you go to Greg. Greg tells me it's a crystal. It's a crystal memento. So this is our token of appreciation, Chris, for a magnificent lecture. We hope it'll remind you of your visit to Australia and that we'll see you here again in the not too distant future.
Absolutely.